welcome to The Image Doctors, August 17th, 2006. I'm Jason Odell.
And I'm Rick Walker.
And we hope you enjoy our show today. We've got a lot of stuff to talk about, a lot of new news from Nikon.
Yep, and one of the first topics that we'll hit is a discussion of the new D80 digital body, as well as a couple lenses that Nikon just recently came out with, the 70-300 and the 18-135. Then we're going to do a little bit of a wrap-up on the RAW converters. We did promise that we would do kind of a high-level summary, pros and cons, and so we'll do that. That'll take just a few minutes, because most of the details have been hit in prior episodes.
And before we start, I mean, I want to thank anyone who signed up and joined us as a silver or higher member since our last episode. We've been getting some feedback from the site owners that said that membership is up. So keep it up, guys.
Yeah, we really do appreciate
that. It helps keep us on the air.
Yeah, because we're one of the higher bandwidth consumers on the Nikon site. The Nikonian site, so it definitely helps. The next topic is one that's a little bit less technical, maybe, but it's just how to break out of the photographic doldrums when you kind of find yourself
mental
stuck
block.
And a lot of your shots are starting to come out kind of the same.
My whole life is a mental block.
So we'll talk a little bit about that, and then we're going to wrap up with a brief discussion of black and white.
Excellent.
And actually, that will be one of the suggestions for breaking out of the doldrums, too, but we'll get to that point.
So let's start with the news of the day, or the news of the week, or last week, which was the announcement by Nikon, not entirely unsurprising, considering they were hyping this.
Yeah.
That's a unique
And there were rumors
Nikon.
Around for a long time on this body.
Nikon usually doesn't say that they're going to announce something and when they're going to announce it, but in this case, they had this teaser on their website, and that new camera is called the D80, and it was also announced with two new lenses.
Right.
And one of those lenses is going to be sold as a kit with the D80.
That's an 18-135.
DX format only.
Right. Non-VR.
And I don't even know what the f-stop is on it. I'll have to go back and look. Check out the specs on it at NikonUSA.com, or we'll post a little bit of details on our show notes page for all this, and with links to the D80 specs and things like that. There was a nice review from our partners at letsgodigital.org. You can read their D80 review, as well as our chief editor Tom Bonet's thoughts on the D80.
Key things on it, though, it's a body that's in the general form factor of the D50, although it does have the sub-command dial up front, which is nice, just like the D70 and D200, etc. It's higher resolution than the D70
megapixel.
Or D50. Yep, so same as the D200, and that's a pretty nice resolution, frankly, for most things that you will do. That's more than enough.
Right.
You could almost make a case that even the 6 is plenty for what most people do with their photos, but this is even better, so that's cool. And it does have, at least for what I value, some features that are pretty darn nice, like the better viewfinder. It has the same viewfinder as the D200 in terms of magnification, and that really does make a difference, especially
a big difference
if you're focusing manually. The biggest complaint I had about the D50 and the D70 and the older D100, etc., was the smaller viewfinder size. It was a little bit tough to focus manually at times.
It also shares the same autofocus module as the D200.
Right.
So that's an upgrade. That's something that you won't get with any of the other consumer oriented bodies from Nikon. It's the CAM 1000. And don't forget, we do have our own digital. Daryl wrote an article about using CAM 1000.
So you'll be able to use it for the D80 as well.
I think some of the features might not, some of the modes might not be there. There's some little differences, but in general,
the
same sensor or the same autofocus module.
Now, one thing that it shares with the D50, but not the D70 or the D200 or the cards. It uses the SD cards rather than the compact flash cards. So those are the smaller ones that unfortunately are not compatible with the D200, the D2X, the D2HS, etc.
And those use compact flash cards.
Right.
So it's a different form factor. If you've never used an SD card, it's much thinner. It does save a lot of room for the memory card slot in the camera. I think that's one of the reasons that they're able to make the D80 smaller. But now, some people may, you have to decide whether or not you want to do that.
Yeah, and unfortunately, there's kind of a decision that's forced there. If you're if you've got a D50 right now and you're looking to move up to a higher end body, this is easy. The D80 is a perfect follow on. You know, it's got the higher resolution, the better viewfinder, and it uses the same flash cards.
And we should mention the price, although it's not set in stone, it looks like the body only for the D80 is going to be sold for about $1,000. $999 is the estimated price.
Right. So $600 to $700 US, less than a D200.
Yes.
So it's appreciably less. And again, if you're using SD cards right now, it's kind of a no-brainer. It looks to be a good value. We haven't handled one yet, obviously. Now, if you're a D200 owner, or a D2X or D2HS owner that's looking for a backup body, and that's something that a lot of people kind of lost when they went digital, especially on the higher end bodies.
When your camera costs $4,500, yeah, it's kind of hard to buy two, and it's really your livelihood.
So then the decision gets a little bit tougher, I think, because if you think about the D80 at a price point of around $1,000, as a backup body, you know, most people want something that if their primary goes out, they can pick up shooting and not have any real loss of shooting capacity or things like that. Then it's hard, because then you're looking at having to buy probably several cards, and that's, you know, a couple hundred dollars at least. And
the larger capacity SD cards really aren't mainstream yet.
No, they're a bit behind the compact flash cards. So then you start coming close to a D200. You're still a few hundred dollars less, but you're starting to get close. And it just may be that the D200 virtues, you know, the beefier body, et cetera, start making it the better choice for people using those higher end bodies. That would be my call, I think, at this point.
I think the D80 positions itself incredibly well from looking at the specs, not having touched the camera, but you know, we'll just throw it out here. Positions itself incredibly well as a very high-end consumer body.
Mm-hmm.
It's got just about everything the casual shooter will want in terms of plenty of resolution. It has all of the settings that you might want, the front command dial, all of the exposure modes that you would want to have.
Mm-hmm.
Great autofocus system. Where does it sort of, what distinguishes it as a consumer body? Why might you want a D200? You might want a D200 if you're upgrading from something, if you want to keep your compact flash cards, if you need that 5 frames per second shooting. And that's one of the differences. The D80 and the D200 use probably the identical sensor, a very similar variants of the same Sony 10.2 megapixel sensor. The D80 uses a 2-channel data offload, while the D200 uses a 4-channel data offload. That 4 channels of data offload means you can shoot faster. It clears that buffer more quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want a magnesium body, or are you happy with a plastic body? We say plastic body like it's a bad thing, but I'll tell you, these polycarbonate plastics that they make these things out of are sturdy as heck.
When I reviewed the D50, you know, and wrote that article a while back, I was quite impressed with how solid it felt. It did not feel
they're good.
Cheap. But, you know, the magnesium ones, et cetera, are a little bit nicer.
So those are sort of decisions. Now, if you're a D70 owner, now you've got a decision that you have. I think these guys are going to be...
That's the hardest one.
That's the I'm in a pickle category. Do you upgrade to a D80? Because in a lot of ways, a D80 makes a D70 obsolete.
There are a few exceptions,
but they're pretty minor.
The flash sync, I think, is one that, you know, a lot of D70 owners like that 1/500th of a second flash sync.
Versus, I think, 1/200th on the D80.
Right.
So that would be a concern. And if you're using a SB800 or 600 and you put it in that FP sync mode and are willing to deal with a slightly reduced
distance,
you can still shoot up to 1/4,000th of a second.
Yeah, it works pretty well for portraits and things like that.
You do get the commander mode with the pop-up flash in a D80. So if you're a D50 owner, that's one of the things that makes it a no-brainer. It's like now you gain the commander mode that you didn't have before. A D70 owner is going to have to think about whether a D80 or a D200 is going to be the upgrade for them.
Yeah, I think in the end, a lot of it comes down to how many flash cards do you own and frequently use. And if it's a lot, if you're a really high-volume user, you end up with the D200 looking economically about the same.
And it uses the same batteries as your D70 and D200.
Yeah.
So that's a good thing, too. And there's a vertical grip available for those people who want to run two batteries and never run out of a chute. Mm-hmm. You can do that, too. Yeah. So anyway. A lot of the things that were people viewed as sort of shortcomings of the D70 have certainly been addressed by the D80.
Yeah.
But as usual, you're going to have to pick some of those features.
Yeah. So at any rate, just a high level, you know, haven't handled it yet, summary of the D80. And
that's what we think.
Yeah.
Our infinite wisdom there.
That's all based on the specs, and sometimes your opinions can be changed when you start handling it. So
yeah, and with any luck, I mean, well, it'll be, without any doubt, Nikonians will get their hands on a D80 soon enough,
yep.
And we'll have an article in our resources section about the D80 mm-hmm. soon enough, and you can check out all the our thoughts on that.
Yeah. Quick mention of the 70-300
lens. Oh, yes. This has been long awaited.
Yeah. A lot of people have been wanting one of those, you know, something less expensive than a 70-200 and more compact, but having the VR feature, which means it'll be a very nice travel lens, most likely. We'll have to see, you know, how the image quality pans out. You know, same comment on,
but it stands
on the
D80.
We've got to shoot with it first. It should be fine. You know, we'll just see. You know, classically, those kind of lenses are a little bit less sharp at the long end than some other mm-hmm. alternatives, but fine for most use. It does have a couple ED elements.
Right. It has one. It has two instead of one, which is the old version.
Right. So, you know, maybe it'll be a little bit better at the 300 millimeter end, but, you know, we'll just have to see.
One thing to keep in mind, if you're looking at this lens, which should be available in October, I think, it is a G designation, so it's not going to have an aperture ring. So if you're looking to use this on an older body that doesn't support command dial aperture selection, mm-hmm. you're going to want to stick with the older one.
Yeah.
But otherwise, on spec, it's the long awaited replacement to the 70-300.
Yeah. Okay. So that's it for the product news. Let's talk a little bit about the RAW converters. And well, we had a chance to play with them for a long time, and you know, we
still haven't mastered them all.
Oh God, no! And that's one of the things, is that there's no way of mastering all of them. So the key to getting good use out of any RAW converter, like we discussed in previous episodes, is spend some time with it and really get it dialed in for your own preferences. One of the things that we found, though, is that if you look at digital photographers, you can almost lump them into a couple camps. I mean, there are a bunch of different ways of doing this, but one of the primary ones has to do with the volume of images that people will shoot and need to convert to
and the turnaround time on those images.
TIFFs or whatever, yeah. And, you know, for a photographer that's shooting a heck of a lot, which isn't either one of us, by the way. We tend to do a little bit more selective stuff and really don't need to convert all of our RAW images and things like that. But if you're, you know, maybe a sports photographer that has to put a whole lot out, or if you're shooting events or things of that
wedding
sort,
photographers, mm-hmm,
then the higher workflow stuff is important to you. And the ones that stand out as having the better capabilities for high volume are, I think, the Bibble converter. That worked very well for that. Makes it easy to copy settings from one to another and batch out a lot of files. ACR, you know, the converter that comes with Photoshop, CS2, or Elements, works very well in that mode. It's also easy to copy settings and batch them out.
And as we said, it integrates with Adobe Bridge, which is a nice thing, too.
Capture One does a good job
job.
It's easy to do that. RAW Shooter did a good job, but it's now kind of a dead converter in a lot of respects.
Yeah, since
the buyout by
RAW
Adobe.
It had been purchased by Adobe. And
it was one of the better converters in that sense, so it'll be interesting to see what happens with Lightroom, you know, which is in a beta mode right now that Adobe put out. You know, there are definitely some plans there to introduce some of the features that RAW Shooter had, but exactly which ones migrate over is another matter. It's going to happen, but
and there's just
I don't
so
think
much
it's going to look,
it's
not gonna look
right
like
now.
RAW Shooter.
There's so much software. I should note that I know everyone's saying, can you review this? Can you mm-hmm. review this? There's so many software modules out there that we just don't necessarily have time to review all of them.
Right.
I mean, I played with Lightroom for a half a day once just to see what it yeah. could do, but I haven't really.
I think it's got some interesting possibilities, but so, I found it a bit awkward at present.
It's still a beta, though, yeah. so we'll have to see.
Exactly. But there's some interesting ideas. You know, for lower volume work, you know, I think both of us have mentioned that we still like using Capture a lot. For me, it saves me time with the kind of stuff I shoot because I like what it does in the way of color palette. I like the auto color aberration control, you know, with super wide lenses. That's important to me. And it's got some other things like that. But it's not a, you know, neither the 4.4 version or NX is really for high volume.
And no, there's really just has too many limitations with the way it saves files.
Exactly. It uses the native NEF file structure, which means when you write to it, it has to save the whole file as opposed to a small sidecar. And that's the thing that usually differentiates, you know, what's a good high volume RAW converter. So it all depends on your preferences, but that's one way that we would sort it out. DxO is probably more in the, despite the fact that it uses sidecars, the current version is probably more like Capture in terms of, you know, higher volume stuff. It's just not one that you would use for shooting lots and lots of images.
Right.
But, you know, we'll have to see how the 4.0 beta version shapes up. It's a little bit too early to tell right now based on the things I've tried with it.
And one thing I should point out, the other kind of photographer, we talked about high workflow, we've talked about sort of fine art photography. Mm-hmm. Kind of like what we do, where you're looking at, you know, picking out a few keepers. And
I don't know if I would call mine fine art, but I try.
Well, you know, we have to categorize it something. Yeah. We aim yeah. high, right?
All right.
Then there's studio shooters mm-hmm. who may be even shooting tethered.
Right.
And for that one, I would really recommend something like Capture One.
Well, the problem is it doesn't work with the Nikon DSLRs, though, in tethered mode. You pretty much have to... You know,
Bibble does,
yeah.
I believe. Bibble can do that.
I haven't tried it, but because the tether doesn't matter.
Capture One is designed for a studio workflow, but it's designed for the studio workflow using the Phase One yeah. digital backs. But it's you know, maybe down the road they'll come out. I mean, their interface is clearly designed with the studio tethered capturing mm-hmm. in mind, and I think that's one of the advantages that, you know, Bibble certainly does. I know that they support the tethered shooting. Mm-hmm. So that's a different kind of
yeah.
photography.
So, you know, for the type that we're talking about there, where you're really kind of trying to fine-tune your image and the color and contrast levels and have it be easy and direct, I do like the Capture converters for that, especially with the control points in NX. That to me is pretty cool and definitely is faster than doing equivalent things in Photoshop. At least for me it is. I find Capture One very simple and direct, and it's easy to get quality images with it. Bibble is pretty easy, although its interface, you know, gets a little bit busy at times, but you can do all that stuff. Mm-hmm. DxO is a little bit harder for me to control in that same sense. It has a tendency to do some things on its own a little bit more than to my taste. So I find it a little bit less direct.
You kind of have to trust yeah. its settings and yeah. work within its parameters.
ACR is pretty direct. I just have a little bit easier time getting the results I like from mm-hmm. Capture, but it's not bad. I think, you know, ACR is an awfully good all-in-one kind of converter. You know, it's pretty decent at a lot of things. It's just that it doesn't have some of the features I like in Capture, like the auto color aberration control. You have to set up a bunch of presets to do the same thing, and there's some equivalent things. Color palettes take a bit more dialing in. Mm-hmm. You can do it, but
Those would be our
ones.
Sort of top choices.
Yeah.
That's where
honestly, I could probably use any one of those, and given a little bit of investment and time, get images that would be just fine.
Exactly.
Yeah, none of them are bad.
No worries.
It's just
that.
All dependent on the kind of stuff that you
and
shoot.
Since we reviewed Capture NX, the version has gone live. Mm-hmm. You can download the 30-day trial and decide if you want to buy it.
Yeah.
Check out the digital workflow forum where we've posted some NX tips and tricks
right.
in the anchored posts.
Yeah. Now you're actually working on an ebook too. That
my dirty little secret in my infinite spare time.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm putting together a ebook. And it's going to go through, it won't be the definitive, comprehensive, every feature of Capture NX explained. I think the Capture NX manual is actually pretty good at that. It's often overlooked.
But it'll be how do you use it in practice,
But I'm
right?
really working on a lot of these recipes where it explains where to do things in the base adjustments versus where to do things in edit steps using the Capture NX tools, how to use the control points to your advantage. And I think the beauty of NX is that you don't need to use 700 control points to make your, you can do a lot of things with two.
Right.
And a few quick steps. So things like highlight recovery, these are all things I'm planning on putting into this book. Yeah. And it should be available in about another month or so.
So there was the shameless self-promotion.
Shameless self-promotion. Yeah. Stay tuned for more info on that.
Okay.
Now, how do we break out of photography doldrums?
Which is the next topic.
Because sometimes you just hit a wall.
Everyone does it.
Usually leaves imprints on my forehead when I do that.
Oh, yeah. And all of a sudden you just feel like, eh, I don't know if I really want to go out and shoot. And all my photos look the same and I'm kind of bored. Maybe I should try a different hobby. And, you know, first thing is sometimes a break is good. You know, if you're finding yourself taking it a little bit too seriously and you're a little bit too upset about your images and you're a little bit too obsessed, then a break might be a good idea. Take a few weeks off, whatever, and don't push it. Don't make yourself unhappy with it. But if you do want to actively do some things to get out of the doldrums, or we're going to talk a little bit about some classic things that worked well. They've worked well for us at different times and others. I think one of the most important things is give yourself permission to not be serious on some shoots. Go out there and don't try necessarily to create a fine work of art. Just experiment and have fun and be willing to throw away every single image that you make.
And this is a lot easier with the digital body.
Yeah, but you can do it with film too. It just back off a little.
Film or something.
Yeah, sometimes trying to be too obsessed about it, worrying about what's the absolute best noise reduction technique or the absolute best raw converter or whatever is really counterproductive. So
at some point,
just try to be good enough. Yeah, exactly.
Images.
Right. So I think that's one key thing. A fun thing is confining yourself to just one lens. And maybe just, you know, make it a prime or just one setting on a zoom lens.
Yeah. I mean, I'll have fun with the, you know, I have the Sigma 1020.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when I'm looking for something fun, I'll go out and you know, because that 10 millimeter focal length is
pretty wild,
crazy wide. And it requires certain kinds of, you know, certain kinds of scenes work well and others don't.
Yeah.
And that challenges me if I restrict myself to that one lens to do that's really fun. But I could also see like going out like the old days when I started out in photography with my Nikon EL2
and a 50
and
probably.
A 50 millimeter lens, right, which is sitting there on the shelf right now. That's the 50 millimeter lens that I had. That was the only lens that was mine. If I wanted another one, I had to borrow it from mom or dad. Mm-hmm. And that didn't always happen.
Yeah.
And that means if you wanted to frame something wider, you had to take a few steps back. And that's a good thing.
But the most important thing is you were forced to find compositions that you wouldn't normally shoot.
Exactly.
Or in that case, I mean, you really had no choice.
I didn't have any choice.
No,
that.
It was that's what you used. But it can be an interesting thing to shake things up, especially if it's with a lens that you don't normally use. Maybe you've got a fisheye. Go out and do shoot with nothing but a fisheye, or doesn't have to be something that exotic. Just force yourself to do something a little bit different.
Another thing that I've thought about doing, and I did this once or twice, it was something that I learned from the Rich Clarkson sports workshop that I took, which is that even if you want to approach making your photography better, you need to have an assignment. Now, maybe you don't work for a photo bureau, you know, a newspaper or a magazine where you're assigned something. Make yourself an assignment. Or even better, check out the forums in Nikonians. A lot of the topics forums, we have an online photography assignments of the month. And it gives you a topic and it says, go out and try to shoot this. And you can post your shots in the forums and see your results. Or just make up something and say, okay, today in town there's a parade. And I'm going to go cover this parade as if I were shooting it for the newspaper.
Yeah.
And do that.
Or I'm going to pretend I don't actually live in my hometown, that I'm from somewhere else, and I'm going to shoot it as if it were a travel shot.
Make a coffee table book out of it.
Yeah. You know, so what would you shoot in your own town? Guaranteed, doesn't matter where you live, there are some things about it that are unique and would be interesting to people from other places. How would you shoot it? to make it that way? What would be some mm-hmm. of those unique cultural aspects to your own hometown?
You know, I just had a thought.
You would cover people and places and history and, you know, who knows what.
Another thing you can do, instead of confining yourself to one lens, confine yourself to a different angle of view.
Mm-hmm.
So many of our pictures we take standing up or with a tripod at eye level.
Good idea.
Why don't you try something and say, you know what, I'm going to shoot everything from lying down on, you know, or whatever. Or I'm going to shoot everything from
down in the dirt,
from a real low or really high perspective. I'm going to try to do things differently.
Maybe everything is tilted.
Yeah, just something to break yourself
tilting
up.
The frame can be kind of fun at times.
It can work.
Yeah. So make yourself shoot everything tilted as opposed to the horizon level. That's a fun thing. All right. Photo books.
These are a great way to get inspiration.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if you pick ones that are maybe a little bit less technical and more toward the images. And I jotted down a list of some of my favorites. And, you know, one of them was Mountain Light by Galen Rowell. One of the classics, and that was one that got me excited about photography, frankly, especially stuff that's landscape or you know, just out in the field.
Mm-hmm.
The one that got me initially interested in photography, though, you know, this was back in high school, was a book by a guy named Elliot Porter. He was a large format photographer. And the specific book was one called The Place No One Knew, which was about Glen Canyon. And I've still got the book. You know, originally I was just looking at it in the school library, but I've got it on my bookshelf and I hadn't looked at it in a few years. And it was funny. I flipped in there and it's like, oh my gosh, I can still see what I'm trying to go after. There are shots in there that uh-huh. are just so similar in some respects to what I like to shoot today. Wonderful book, beautiful images. I think it was published back in the early 60s. Great stuff. I like most of the things done by Art Wolf. Not an icon photographer anymore, but who cares? This is all about
the photos. If
you're
trying to get pictures, it doesn't matter what camera
took.
No, it
really does not matter. And he's got some great things on a variety of topics. I would just simply say, you know, go to Amazon.com, go to your local bookstore, whatever, and look for things by Art Wolf. Beautiful stuff.
Landscapes. Another good one is John Shaw.
Mm-hmm.
Landscapes and wildlife.
Yeah, and some of his books are a little bit more technical, some are less.
But even the ones that are technical have just a lot of really nice images in them.
Yeah, you can't go wrong
really
there.
Really good.
A photographer that's well-known here in Colorado, where both of us live, is a guy named John Fielder. He's primarily a large format photographer, but does wonderful, very natural-looking landscapes. And one that's a little bit more on the technique side of the house is Photographing the Landscape. If you are interested in landscape photography, it's a nice book, but beautiful images. And most of his others are just, you know, photo books, but gorgeous, really nice, and they'll give you some ideas. And the last one I had on there is Franz Lanting, who is an icon photographer, but, you know, very creative, very nice images that don't rely, frankly, on technical perfection. If you look in his books, you know, there are plenty of them that have some vibration or shake or aren't precisely sharp, but they're beautiful. And it's a good reminder that you don't have to obsess over, you know, precisely perfect technique.
Yeah.
It's all about the idea and the image and some gorgeous stuff. So anyway,
yep. Those are all good. And if I could add one other thing to the list, because mm-hmm. I know that our list is kind of biased towards our interests.
It is. Yeah.
Which is landscapes, wildlife, outdoorsy kinds of stuff. But lots of good books recently, you know, 50-year anniversary edition compilations from National Geographic.
Which, by the way, just read a National Geographic magazine.
That's true. That's a good one.
Yeah.
Life magazine, you know, best pictures of the last 50 years kind of stuff. You're looking for more of the photojournalism angle, a lot more black and white.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of those classic pictures, they're there. You know, anything by the heavy-hitting masters, anything by Ansel Adams, mm-hmm. anything by Bresson. But, mm-hmm. you know, go and get some inspiration. Go down to your local bookstore or check out Amazon.com and do that.
A couple last things that we were thinking about as ideas. One, shoot some film. If you still have a film camera and have been primarily using digital, do something to mix it up a little bit mm-hmm. by getting a roll of slide film or whatever. roll a black and white film. We're going to talk more about black and white in the middle. But shoot some film. It'll put you into different right. thought process. Related to that, maybe go out on a shoot and limit the number of shots that you can bring home with you.
Yeah, back to the days where you only had right. 36 exposures per roll.
Or maybe or, even do less than that.
Yeah, try.
10 or 12.
Try something small.
How do you make them the ones that truly count? And don't go for just the average kind of shots. This is especially true if you're shooting digital, because there's a temptation to shoot just a heck of a lot. Mm-hmm. And you can end up with a heck of a lot of mediocrity.
Yeah.
So that's one thought.
One thing I like to do is learn a new technique, and not necessarily learn, but go back and say, you know what? I'm going to confine myself to shooting in manual metering mode. And on top of that, I'm going to confine myself to shooting in spot metering mode and really retrain my brain on how to pick out tonality values in my surroundings. And say, yeah, this is
slow down a bit
and just, and compare that to what I get with the matrix metering or center weighted metering and say, hey, here's what, because there might be times when this will come in handy later on, because you'll realize that, hey, I'll get a better exposure on this if I just shoot that in spot. So that's something that I do every now and then. Just take your camera out of the automatic settings,
right,
and make yourself learn it manually.
Then the last one that we had down on the list that is going to be a kind of a separate topic in its own is shooting in black and white. And most photographers anymore shoot in color. I've got to admit, most of my stuff is in color, although I do try to do a certain amount of black and white. I don't really put much of it up on my website for some bizarre reason. I need to do more of that. But whether you're shooting with film or if you're shooting with digital, it's not that hard to do black and white, and it's a completely different thought process and look than color, and it's quite beautiful, right? I mean, there's some wonderful photos that have been made in black and white, and in some circumstances, it really can be the better choice. One of the things that we were talking about earlier is my son and I have got reservations on a trip to Vienna and Prague and Budapest, but it's in early January, so there won't be a lot of flowers blooming. That I'm sure there won't be at all, and it won't be green like it would be at other times of the year, but you know, wonderful architecture and some beautiful places. So one of the things I'm kind of thinking about is just making a black and white trip just for fun and just doing the whole thing that way. What I'll probably do is take my D200, which has got a black and white mode, and I'll shoot in RAW, which means if I want to, even on shots that I was initially thinking were black and white, I can always make them into color later. But it'll put me into that frame of mind when I look, if I check the LCD in the back, it'll show a black and white image. But I'm just going to have this mindset from the start that it'll be black and white.
That's a great way of doing it. And there's a lot of more black and white conversion options out there in software for digital shooters. I still think there's something about shooting Tri-X film, mm-hmm. that, because there's such a great dynamic range to it.
Yeah, and the grain actually looks quite cool in my opinion.
It does, but it's getting harder and harder to get your black and white film processed.
It is,
unless you do it yourself. So,
and frankly, with doing film, unless you're doing it yourself, you give up a lot of the advantages of black and white film photography, in my opinion,
right, which was the control of the processing in the darkroom.
Yeah.
So do those things.
Now, we've talked about some things that can be done for digital, mm-hmm. in the past. You know, I hinted a little bit at the black and white mode, which is something showing up in more and more cameras.
Yeah, the newer cameras have that.
But you don't need that in order to do black and white. It's just maybe a fun alternative. But you can do several things. A simple one, if you have Photoshop, is to use the channel mixer function. I'll let you look that up, but you can use that to convert an image to monochrome, and then use the color sliders to do things similar to what you would have done with color filters.
Correct.
In black and white in the past. So, you know, for example, shifting it more toward the red direction gives a look like a red filter in black and white, which makes for really dramatic Ansel Adamish kind of skies. And of course, that was a guy that we should have added to the list of photo books too, right? And you can do similar things with yellow for a little bit less dramatic thing, green for changing foliage, right, and things like that.
Black and white is all about tone and contrast. Mm-hmm. And so what you're trying to do is separate out things by increasing or decreasing the contrast between tonal values, mm-hmm. and you can take the same image and decide to process it three different ways and have three different moods.
Yeah.
In the same
dramatically picture. Different moods.
Very different, depending on what you emphasize. And channel mixer is one really good way of doing that.
Yeah. We talked about alien skin exposure long time ago now, and both of us are still using it.
I really
love
it.
For black and white conversions, and it does a very nice job. It's very user-friendly on those, and the grain effects are nice. You know, we were talking about Tri-X and that look. You really can replicate it pretty decently. Now, digital black and white, unless you do some really fancy things, isn't going to have quite the tonal range of black and white film, but it's still pretty good.
Right.
And you can produce prints that look very nice.
Now, there is some, if you get really fancy, there's some ways of doing things in black and white, staying completely in RGB mode. And there is a resource from a Nikon photographer, Vincent Versace, if you've ever heard of him. He's got a DVD out on his website about how to do advanced black and white conversions all in RGB.
Yeah, I'm thinking about ordering that.
And it looks really complicated, but I'm not sure because I don't own the DVD. I don't have it. But he talks about ways of replicating every black and white effect from sepia tone to different kinds of papers, all in the RGB color space without ever leaving the RGB color space.
We had a chance to meet him down at the PMA show and talk to him for a while. Yeah, a very smart guy. And I have no doubt that his ideas will produce some outstanding
But I think that's
images.
For the people who really want a challenge to try to sit down.
Yeah, you can do simpler things.
You can do it a lot easier. I will say this. I had an opportunity a couple of weeks ago to go to Chicago, and I was working with a photographer there who does a lot of, and I was teaching him how to do some workflow stuff, and one of the things he really likes is black and white. He shot a lot of black and white in the past, and I was showing him how to use alien skin exposure because he had purchased this particular module. And we made some very large prints. He had an Epson 4000 printer. And so we made a print in black and white that was at least, I think, you know, it was like a 16 by 20-ish size, which we used with the film grain from the Tri-X module. And it looked great. Mm-hmm. It looked just great. The grain gave it a very natural appearance. It did what it was supposed to do.
Yeah.
So I can vouch for that particular software, at least in terms of being able to generate large prints from it and have them look good.
You know, one other thing that I've used is one that's made by PhotoKit. I think it is just called PhotoKit, and it includes some nice black and white conversions, you know, red and green, et cetera, some of the things I was mentioning. And it does a good job as well. The grain aspect isn't there like it is with alien skin exposure. I think that's probably still the top of the market at the moment.
Right. Now, there is some grain that you can add in Capture NX. That's one of the NX features, and in black and white conversion, which offers a little bit more control than what you would get from just doing a straight black and white or desaturation mode and color filter options. So it's there.
And Photoshop has some grain things too. They're just not up there at that
level. Personally, I don't like Photoshop's grain because it doesn't allow you to get anything larger than a pixel.
Yeah.
So I'm not thrilled to death with that, and I think I would stick with one of the other ones if you want to add grain.
Yeah.
But
the most important thing is think about black and white, though. I think if you try it a bit, you know, do several shoots with it, really try to make it work, you might be very excited by the option it presents to color. And that might help you break out of one of those ruts that we were mentioning earlier.
Right. Now, I'll leave it with one thing about black and white, and that is then you want to make prints of it. It is going to... You're going to see differences if you try to make black and white prints on a color inkjet printer. Some of the printers just will give you a color cast unless you print them in black only.
Yeah.
Using just the black ink cartridge. Then you generally don't get the kind of tonality range out of your printer that you could with using 6 or 8 inks.
Right.
And some of the newer printers, I think like some of the newer Epson, like the 2400, do add in more black.
Yeah, it's
black
that, that's the printer I've got, and it's in addition to black, and it's got a different black, whether it's glossy paper or matte black or matte paper.
So if you're serious,
it's also got two shades of gray.
Yeah,
a lighter one and a darker one.
And this tends to eliminate that color. Like I have a printer, and if I do black and white, mine they either look green or they look magenta. They never look right.
Yeah.
So if you're serious about black and white, and you want to make prints of it, you might want to think about.
Yeah, because with those printers, there is no color cast, and the black and white prints look great, which is the whole reason I got that printer, actually. Mm-hmm. Although there's some other advantages, too.
Well, we're just about done. There's one thing that we need to mention. We sort of did the shameless self-promotion department earlier. A few months ago, we mentioned that we were seeking people who are interested in going down to South Texas with us for a bird photography workshop. We've gotten a bunch of responses already, and for those people who have responded, we thank you for your interest. We haven't forgotten about you.
Nope.
Our plan is to have enough people. We're going to make a decision as to the trip by the end of September. We want to have pricing and all of these things sort of set if we have enough interested people. So again, just to remind you, if you're interested at all in going down to Texas with Rick and myself in late April or early May of 2007, we haven't set a date yet, please drop us an email to talkradio@nikonians.org. And we'll add you to our interested parties list, and we will then contact you directly with the information once we've figured out the logistics of it, if there's enough interest in making it worthwhile to do.
Yep. But it was a fun shoot.
It was. It would be
probably
very,
could tell
very
from
good.
That podcast that we did a while back.
Right. And you can find all those podcasts, and if you haven't listened to that, go back to our show notes page from blog.nikonians.org, and you can click on the Image Doctor show notes and get all of our back issues.
Yeah. And what number are we up to?
This is episode 21.
That's amazing.
I can't imagine how we've managed to do 20, but here we are. We're still alive, and they haven't thrown us off the air yet. So
that's a good thing.
It's a great thing.
Okay. I think that wraps it up for this week then.
Until next time, enjoy, your shooting, enjoy your Nikons, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.
Bye-bye.